out. He couldn't have been calling Adam hiding in the shrubbery. It is about both of these things, and it has really taken from a part of the Old Testament, right at the beginning. And we want to say why we have drawn it in the way we've drawn it, why God is represented without specific edges, and why Adam has fairly clear edges, and why he's rolled up as if he's hiding from something. He says in the Bible that Adam committed a crime. He disobeyed God. Committing a crime, of course, is doing something against the law, generally of the social structure in which a man lives. Committing a sin is, of course, committing something against God. Sin is a theological concept. But every sin is also against an intelligent man's social code, and therefore sin and crime both refer to the same thing, viewed from two different sides, one the theological and the other the social. Now it is stated that God said to Adam, you can do anything you like, you can eat all these trees and their fruits, every green herb shall be for meat, but one tree you must not eat, and that is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. We write good and evil here. And God is saying to Adam, do not eat of that fruit of the tree that confers the knowledge of good and evil. Now he said this for a very definite reason. And there are many heretical ways of looking at it. One of the presentists is on a little record sung by Donald Swan, actually. A song of Sidney Carter's, in which it is stated that God deliberately made man and woman and the serpent and the apple as part of a very large plan. But the implication of it is that God has got everything tied up and there's no room for freedom, whereas in fact there is a little room for free and less room for dome. When God said to Adam, don't distinguish between good and evil, he's saying so for a very definite reason. Now, it is not very likely that man will obey God, but it isn't inconceivable that he might. And this conceivability that he might obey is the ground of saying that God did not precipitate of necessity man into this error, this sin or crime. Let's examine what good means and what evil means. And we've said before that good is the will, the do, to a limit, D. We compare good, that's in the belly, better in the head, and best in the heart. This is the way we compare it. Good, better, best. Now God has said tree of good and evil, and they're opposed to each other. Good means to will to a limit. Now evil is anti-lives, and means anything whatever that you do that causes your death. And God says to Adam, if you do distinguish between these two, you shall surely die. And this means that God has a very definite meaning for death, because he knows, as a matter of fact, that his own spirit, which is in Adam, is eternal and immortal. And therefore the spirit of God in Adam, which made Adam into a living soul, as it says that God breathed his spirit into man and man became a living soul, the spirit of God is eternal, and therefore he cannot die in the sense of being disintegrated and ceasing to exist. You may remember in the Bhagavad Gita it says, whatever is cannot cease to be, and whatever is not cannot come to be. This is the statement about the ultimate substance of reality. Whatever it is, it can never cease to be what it is. So evil means anti-life. Cannot mean this in any absolute sense. It can only mean it in a relative sense. When God says to Adam, you shall surely die if you distinguish between good and evil, then he must be using the word die in a very special way. We'll see what way he's using it in a moment. then God reasons to it, he goes away, so that they can have space to obey or disobey. And while he's away, the serpent comes along, and at that time the serpent had two legs. You know that the python has vestigial legs inside its skin. It was once a biped serpent. It's still got the little legs in the skeleton to show this fact. And the statement is made that it was demoted from being a biped. It was reduced to a belly part. It was forced to go upon the ground, and this had a very definite meaning. When it was a biped, it meant to say that it was a dualist. Everything in religious scriptures is symbolical. And the serpent is a dualist. He is going about on two legs. And he is saying there are two principles in existence, the principle of matter and the principle of energy or spirit. And he tempts man through woman. Now we know that when the human being is considered as a whole, he has four parts. He has a part of the head part, intellect, which is called cognition by the psychiatrist, a part called the affect or emotional feeling part, and a part called the cognitive or primary drive part, and the coordinated spine. Man is already a fourfold being. Now, two parts are what we call female parts, and two parts are what we call male parts. Now, we know that the figure of eight, involving the chest and sub-diaphragm regions, the feeling and belly department, feeling and urge, is specifically stressed in woman. We know that this is the reason why a woman bears the child, why her pelvis is built differently from a man's and so on. She is stressed in this urge and feeling evaluation. But the man is stressed in the intellectual centers, in the forebrain and in the spinal cord. The spinal cord is the thing where the initiative, the decision to stress one center or another is situated. So when God takes Eve out of Adam, it is equivalent to stressing those aspects of her being that leave out the intellect and the initiative. And if we remove the initiative and intellect from the being, all that we have left is a being that will tend to respond to a stimulus without consideration of the result. If the stimulus is present, it will move towards it, and if it is painful, it will move away from it. It will do this without any rational evaluation. So the serpent, which symbolizes the external stimulus, goes to the woman, goes to Eve, and tells her something that she hadn't thought about first. When the command was given by God, do not understand the meaning of good and evil. Don't eat that fruit. If you do, you will die. The serpent says of this, you will not die. Now the serpent is fully aware that the Spirit of God cannot die. But he's also aware that the word die means division. We only know that a body is dead when it corrupts. If it doesn't corrupt, we cannot truly say that it is dead. If a human being goes into a very deep coma and shows no breathing and no heartbeat, there would be a rather too hasty tendency to define that person as dead. So it is better to wait a bit till the smell starts coming and the evidence of fleshly corruption is seen clearly, otherwise a mistake could be made. Corruption, or breaking in bits, or division of the being, is another meaning of die. If we look at the word die, the important part about it is the D. The other part means affirmation. I-E-E-A-E-A means affirmation. To die is to affirm division, to corrupt, to break in bits. Now, the serpent says to Eve, you will not die in the sense that you didn't understand God then, and because you are an eternal spirit of God, you cannot die. You participate in the continuum of God's power, therefore you cannot disintegrate. Nevertheless, you can be divided. You can be divided in your action, functionally, by the simple process of identifying with the different parts of experience. You can identify with your right hand, your left hand, and you can take your right hand and thump your left hand very hard if you wish. You can hit your left knuckles with your right knuckles and hurt them. This is a fact that anybody can prove by simple experiment. It is possible for this unific being, this man who is a whole being, to use parts of himself against himself and so injure himself. And in this sense, he can doubt. He can take a knife and seek to cut off portions of his own matter. He cannot kill the eternal spirit of God which constitutes his humanity, but he can in fact greatly impede his action by making the body act against itself. So that die in this sense means to act against oneself, to contradict oneself. And the devil knows very well, the devil is of course embodied in the serpent, so the devil means divider. He knows very well that it is possible to act against oneself, because actually he has already done it, to demonstrate the possibility. And God has said, you will die, and he has meant you will be divided against yourself by the act of distinguishing between good and evil. And the serpent has said to Eve, you will not die, and he has meant that you will not eternally pass away, because you cannot, because you are the spirit of God. So Eve, who is not very subtle in her argument, can't see this point. And she says, it's very nice to look at, and it's nice to taste, and it confers knowledge of good and evil, and we shall be like God. So she eats it. That is to say, the external stimulus causes a being to respond to the stimulus on the feeling level, and produces within the feeling a bias which produces a drive. So the feeling, once it is mobilized reactively to the stimulus, becomes cognition, it becomes a drive. The being then goes into action. But Eve then proceeds to present to Adam the apple, the fruit, and he also is led to eat it. Now he is the intellect and the initiative. This means that the feeling side of being, responding to the stimulus on the calculus of pleasure pain, passes into a cognitive drive which commits the whole body, including the intellect and the initiative, with it. So now the male part of the being is gone into bondage because of the pleasure pain calculus. Now you know that most philosophers have accepted that man functions entirely on a pleasure pain basis, that everything he does is determined by sensations which are pleasant and sensations which are painful, and that man in general is so determined by this that experimentally, statistically, it can be said that most men will respond precisely in this way. They will function by moving towards the pleasant and away from the unpleasant, and they will do this so regularly that there is very little ground for believing in the possibility of a free response. By free we mean a response unconditioned by pleasure pain, a response conditioned entirely by pure reason and initiative, with the initiative deciding what part of the reason to put into effect. Good means to will to a certain limit, and evil is anti-life. Now, in our own economy, inside our body, in the stomach, we make an acid which is very, very biting. We make it in the stomach to bite the food in order to digest it. If physical science today wants to make this acid, it needs a very high temperature to do it. But a human being can make this acid at blood temperature in his stomach without damaging himself. Now, this acid, if it is released in other places other than the ones evolved for it, is a very destructive acid. We can say that this acid is anti-life, except in the place where it was evolved. If you take some of it and squirt it at the back of your nose, like you do when you're being sick after celebrating and wiping, you will find that it's a very, very unpleasant sensation, whereas in the normal stomach it isn't a bit unpleasant. So it is possible to get a living being in which processes that are against life are utilized to sharpen life. The acids, certain bitter elements in the body, the sharp elements in the body, which in isolation are highly unpleasant, in combination with other things in the body, are like salt to a meal. They make it appetizing, they make it possible to sharpen up the awareness of existence without destroying it. This means that the anti-life chemistry can be used as a sharpener of the awareness of life itself. And God has already solved this problem. He has taken all the sharpnesses that are called the sting of death and so on, all the fierce spirits which precipitate themselves as violent poisons at the material level. He's taken all these proportions and relations with other chemicals that are mild and life promoting, and he's brought them in such a proportion together and solved the problem so that all these anti-life things are in fact life promoting by sharpening the awareness that would otherwise be just a very, very gentle, rather negative kind of quiet existence. The evils sharpen up the goods. And God had already solved this problem, and this is why he said to Adam, don't separate the good and the evil. He gave him fair warning. He didn't expect him to obey, and he didn't expect him to disobey, because God does not expect. God is infinite. God is omnipresent. Therefore, there is nothing ex of God, and therefore he does not expect. He frequently inspects, because everything is inside. But he doesn't look out, because there is no out. So he cannot expect. He does not expect Adam to disobey, and he doesn't expect him to obey. Consequently, Eve is looking at the thing as a logical possibility. When God creates, by the act of creation, create means to circumscribe, to arc. When he creates, he necessarily brings into being that which can be represented by a circle. To create is to circumscribe. And when he brings something into being by circumscribing, what he has circumscribed is a zone of himself within the infinite of himself. And the continuum of God's Spirit runs straight through, just as the paper on which I am drawing is underneath the circle I have drawn. The paper underneath the circle represents the infinite Spirit of God. The circle I have drawn represents a given zone demarked from other zones by the rotation of force introduced into it. Now, inside the circle and outside the circle, the qualitatively are identical. That is to say, what is in the circle is exactly the same as the outer spirit beyond the circle. Beyond the circle we call the transcendent Spirit of God. Within the circle we call the immanent Spirit of God. And the immanent Spirit of God in man is what man calls his intelligence, his consciousness. Now this immanent Spirit of God inside man, if it were to function from inside, without an external stimulus, would always function perfectly. This means that the perfect response is inside every man's possibility of showing. When Christ says, "Be ye perfect," he is referring to this fact. And if a man can refer to his own center, instead of paying attention to the external stimulus, if he refers to his own center, that center will give him the pure response for any situation in which you may find yourself. Now God has said to Adam, don't separate the good and the evil, but if you do, two things will happen to you. First of all, you will make war against yourself because you will have zoned your body. Supposing a man decides to find out what is good or evil in himself, and being a sort of empirical fellow, he does experiments. So he cuts little bits off himself, and he takes samples of them, and he gets all the various secretions from the different glands in his body, and he tastes them, and he sorts them out into pleasant and unpleasant. And he calls the unpleasant ones evil, because they, in the experimental conditions, produce an anti-life effect. So he says, I will get rid of the evils. So he takes all the glandular secretions that taste horrid, and he starts throwing them out of the body. Now, if he succeeds at all, then immediately his consciousness loses sharpness. He becomes dull-witted. In fact, he wonders what the experiment he was doing his. And he tends to forget it and to discontinue the experiment, because he's now not even sharp enough to do it. So luckily the experiment tends to get forgotten, because now he's not sharp enough to remember it. And after a time, because he's not throwing it out anymore, he starts becoming sharp again. And when he becomes sharp, then he remembers he was doing an experiment and that he forgot about it. And maybe, if he's very foolish, he starts throwing it out again. And after a sufficient number of times, which is said to be in certain Indian philosophies, in their subtle language for expressing all things, times very many, then he decides that maybe they've got a function, because when he throws them out, he gets his help. So he now decides to try to find out what they do for him. So he starts pinching them from other beings, like animals and other humans when they're not looking, and squirting them into himself, and then he finds he becomes terribly sharp, and bursts out in various types of rashes. And he becomes terribly sharp, and he knows he is, because now he can't rest at night. He's profoundly irritated and terribly aware of his being. And again, of course, for very many times he persists in this experiment, and then after a few thousand years he realizes that maybe balance has got something to do with it. And when he gets near to the idea of balance, he's getting near to the idea that God was referring to when he said, don't separate good and evil. Realize that good and evil are both valid substances, each one with its own function, and that it is entirely a matter of balancing the forces of good and the forces of evil. Now, if Adam had obeyed God, the universe would have developed in a totally different way. Imagine a man who has not divided good from evil, so that he has not responded to the external stimulus, and he is developing from his own center. And the amazing thing about it is that the man who develops from his own center cannot make a mistake. He will always proceed to push his perimeter out into any shape that he decides, and he will push it as far as his will pushes it. He will take it as far as do goes to be, and he will say, lo, it is good. When God is creating in this way, he makes everything according to the six categories of existence and the one category of equilibration of rest, and each time he does something, because he always stops, because he's working from within, stops where he feels like stopping, it is correct for him to say, and lo, it is good. Now, if a man develops from inside in this way, he will take his four parts and he will feel his own being, and he will comprehend the law of his own being. Better means Bet Torah, house of the law. He will know how much energy he wishes to push, to what limit, how much due to D, and his own essence will be fixed entirely according to himself. He will be an absolutely self-determining creative being. Now, this is the ideal for any being. And when God gave Adam the opportunity of obeying this, having created him, when he said, don't divide these and just go on multiplying. Now, in fact, a being developing from its own center in this way could precipitate further beings from itself, identical with itself, all of them terribly intelligent. Now, we know that we see evidence of this in the simple process of budding. We see that in the development of an egg into an embryo, that it does it by a process of budding. A force inside can be watched progressively, especially with today's techniques. We can take cine films of the developing embryo, and we can see that, in fact, this egg actually, from forces within itself, pushes itself out in various ways, and it gradually buds out and makes itself into a being from inside. When it's pushed out one rather fat bud, which will later be an arm, puts five little buds on, which will later be fingers. I've got a prickly cactus at home, it's got six new buds on it like this, and they've grown quite quickly, and they all started off with a sort of martial flare, very pink tips to begin with, and then elongating and going cooler. That is actually a symbology of the colour changes in this, terribly interesting. And the fact is that any being can develop in principle from inside its own center. And when it does so develop, its development is necessarily perfect. That is to say, it is determined by this being's self-purpose. It is going as far as it wants to go. And consequently, it cannot make a mistake. A mistake is taking something amiss. And this it cannot do if it is developing from its own center. So it is God's intention to Adam, if Adam can take that right, although he's free to refuse it, for Adam to become such a being that he can, by concentrating in his own center, construct from his own center and produce other beings designed by him to fulfill the purpose of creation. But unfortunately, he doesn't do this. Something in him is functioning in a way from his own freedom, and he doesn't work it out properly, and he says, please give me assistance from outside. And he requests a helper from outside, and God lets him have a look at the animals. He rejects these, they're not nice enough. And then God says to him, well, I'll have to put you to sleep, take a bit of your own substance and give you a helper. Now, Adam did say a helper. He didn't say make me a co-equal. Otherwise, he'd have got another Adam to argue the case with. He wanted a slightly inferior being, because he wanted to dictate what the helper should do. So God thereupon took out of him the inferior or inbearing part, namely the lower part of the being. And this was called Eve. The word in the Hebrew actually means to develop. That whereby Adam is going to develop. He needs help. He's asked for it. He's now going to get it. Maybe someday he had not to ask for help. So he gets his help, and the first thing the help does, as usual, I don't know if you know about daily help, keep a sharp eye on them, otherwise they will locate a serpent in the cupboard and start something. When the external stimulus comes to the helper, because the helper, of course, is inferior, that's to say, a certain chemical suppresses on its intellect, therefore it does not have the power to resist the pleasant stimulus. It takes the pleasant stimulus and proceeds to construct a lovely fantasy about what it's going to do. It always has a threefold reason for everything. It is pleasant to look at, it's very nice to taste, and it will confer power and make you like God, which is not a very bad condition to have this threefold clarity like he has. It then takes it and corrupts Adam's intellect and destroys his initiative, and now they're in a very peculiar position. Once upon a time, Adam was a hermaphrodite. And at his own request, God has divided him into two. And the rabbis say he was created face to face as a whole being. And when Eve was given to him, they were face to face. But unfortunately, Eve had naturally a back part, sometimes called posterior. And if the serpent happened to be running around the town on his two legs, he bit it. And this gave Eve the idea, and she gave it to Adam. Now, as soon as this happened, they were both invaded with a very serious feeling called guilt. Now, the cause of the guilt was quite a simple one. It was the awareness that they had, in fact, been dictated to from outside. A being that is developing from inside itself cannot make a mistake. If people could comprehend this, they wouldn't bother to turn the flamethrowers on the mobs and rockets. They would understand that those beings have to develop from inside. If two beings are brought together and touch each other, we call this the contingent relationship, and at the point of contact, a reverberation goes through both beings, and this reverberation is in fact a clouding of the essential intelligence of each of those beings. The being is now being conditioned by the external stimulus. Straight away, the being is presented with another occasion of choice. Will I deliberately remove myself from this external stimulus and recenter myself, or will I stay in the relation and be further conditioned? And in fact, what happened, of course, was that they stayed in the relation. They became aware that they had been stimulated from outside, that the stimulus had gone through and had produced a clouding of the pure consciousness than they previously had. Now, they were aware of a clouding of consciousness. Now, guilt means the consciousness that the G-U-I-L, that is the will, is crucified. Guilt means the consciousness that one's will has been crucified by one's own activity. One does something, and as a result of this, one finds that one's efficiency is impaired. As soon as they felt the clouding of consciousness, they were feeling guilt. Guilt is another word for the consciousness that the will has crucified itself, and it knows that it has done so because now its consciousness is clouded in a way that it could not be clouded if it operated always from inside itself. When the continued stimulus dominates, then gradually the domination of this builds up to such a pitch that the consciousness of the creative center disappears. Now, most people today actually have a real belief that contingent relation is the only kind of relation possible. The Blow You Jack school is really no more than the logical development of this fact that people are empirical materialists. Empirical materialism simply says, I believe in the contingent stimulus. I do not believe in a creative center. If you care in your leisure time to work out the implications of believing that there is only an external stimulus, then you will find that this belief is the most profoundly irrational belief any so-called scientist could have accepted. Because the fact is that when the continued stimulus comes, there is a response from in the being. This response is from in the being. And to ignore this inner response and pretend that the contingent stimulus has in fact produced the action is almost an acrobatic feat of thought. To reject the idea that there is an internal principle in the being creating the response is to pretend that there is only an external contingent relation and that there is nobody there, really. So the whole universe then becomes a system of contingent relations. Now, there is a philosopher that deals with this, rather suddenly, and they believe that there aren't any things in the universe at all. There are just events. And that one event contingently acts on another event, and there's nobody there. Of course, the fellow who wrote the book isn't there either. The amazing thing is that he managed to get it published by somebody who wasn't there, and sold it and shared a profit. The important thing to realize is that the closure that results from Adam's disobedience comes from his consciousness of guilt. After he has become aware that his consciousness is already clouding, he can no longer think clearly because of giving in to the external stimulus, he becomes aware that he is darkened. Now he feels a degeneration of power, a degeneration of intelligence. And because of this, he hides himself, and so the story says, and Adam felt guilty and he hid himself. Now, in the corner of this picture here, which we would call non-neuralgically, the left corner, Adam is shown as a kind of a plum-like being, because you know that the tree of knowledge of good and evil had fruits, which had been variously said to be strawberries, apples, pineapples, pomegranates, and anything whatever that you could remotely associate with sex. But the idea of sex, of course, has very little to do with the idea that sex is understood or misunderstood. Sex simply means the sectioning of being. When Adam has requested help, he's requested that he be sectioned. Now, at the precise point of his clouding of consciousness, where he becomes obsessed with guilt, he hides. He hides in the garden. Garden means the place of the judgment on the gullet. A garden, of course, is a place of the garden. There's a garden. And there's a tree inside there, and there's Adam hiding in the garden place, where the gullet is actually already judged absolutely. The gullet, of course, is another aspect of your will. Now, as soon as they become conscious of it, God comes walking in the garden, that is to say, conscience, come science, all that Adam knows, that is come science, with all he knows that he has made a mistake. He's been given a clear instruction about something, he has disobeyed it, and now his consciousness is clouded. He can't understand properly. And he becomes aware that God is walking and he hides himself. And God very kindly calls to him to give him an opportunity to turn round, another occasion of choice. And he says, "Where, Adam, where are you?" And Adam finally comes out in the open and blames his wife. Now, at this point, the two who are created face to face now go back to back. And in that position they have remained ever since. From the moment that Adam had blamed his wife, he had actually turned his back on her. And when she blamed the serpent, she had turned her back too. She should have turned round to Adam. She would must know, words we don't use, and persuaded him to tell the truth. They could have reformed and had a fresh start, and they could have been fused together, and she could have disappeared in Adam, and he could have gone on with the good work. None of which, of course, he did. So they were turned back to back, which means that they no longer look at each other face to face. They do not betray to each other their innermost processes, and they are both profoundly guilty because they cannot tell each other the truth, because one of them made a mistake and passed the mistake to the other. Eve feels terribly guilty because she actually gave this truth to her poor husband, and he feels terribly guilty because he has given the game away. He's actually exposed her. He is feeling guilty because he should have been strong enough to refuse. She is feeling guilty because she's weak enough to listen to the external stimulus or serpent. And now they are back to back. And they remain back to back in the human race right up to the time of the birth of Christ. And he turned them round in himself. And you know that he describes the condition of a balanced man as that of a divine hermaphrodite, an angelic being who is male-female, unified with himself, his intellect and initiative has come to terms with his feelings and his primary urge, and he is facing himself fully in his four parts, absolutely conscious of the meaning of these parts to himself, so he no longer needs any external aid. The Eve and the Adam are now face to face again in him. Now, the way it became possible for Christ to do this was foreshadowed in the thing that God did immediately after Adam had committed the crime and hidden and failed to own up. He demoted the serpent, removed his duality principle, and pushed him down on his belly onto the ground. In other words, he made the serpent into a materialistic monist. Now, a materialistic monist is any being who believes that matter is all in all, and there is nothing other than matter. There is no spirit, there is no intelligence, there is just matter. If you want to read possibly the most popular exponent of monistic materialism, read Sirius Haeckel, who's German, disguised under the name of Ernst Haeckel. He wrote the materialistic monistic theory. In this theory, there is no room whatever for intelligence or spirit or feeling or compassion or understanding. It is just the banging together of a lot of little billiard balls, which happen to fall into certain patterns. Now, the serpent was demoted to this level, meant to say that what was previously an energy perceived by Adam and Eve in their brightness as an energy before the fall, when they had fallen and their consciousness clouded, they could now no longer see the energy form of the serpent, and they now saw the serpent only as a material object. And in this picture you see a sort of spiral drawn with many little flames, and this symbolizes, of course, the spiraling in and out of energy to create and dissolve matter. The absolute force translating to infinity comes in and rotates, and in its rotation constitutes a material atom or molecule or compound, stays in it for a time and then goes out again. I've represented this rather like a small child's best quality letter L, which in fact is what it is. It is the letter which ties together spirit and matter, the link letter. The fiery energies of the absolute wind in and they become the material world. Now, before the clouding of his consciousness by the external stimulus, Adam could actually see the fiery energies around the material body. You know that there are sensitive people today that either get on TV doing ESP experiments, that they show that it is possible to become aware of a thing other than by the direct application in contact of your finger. You know that today a high percentage of students have been shown to be able to detect colour by their fingers, even with a sheet of perspex over blindfold, and they can detect. This means there is a kind of sensitivity other than the one of the five special sense organs. The five special sense organs have been cut down through the clouding of consciousness from the external stimulus and cut down to such a level that what the average human being is looking at, what most people are looking at, is the gross material center of a cloud of energy, the cloud of energy itself not being seen. And when the stimulus of the serpent came to Eve, it was actually in the form of a fiery serpent, that is to say, of a twisting zone of energy with bipolarized turns in it, where the polarization form and power, or ideation and conation, were seen as bright spots within a continuously curling field of energy. But this energy was condensed after the clouding of the consciousness, and from that point, the consciousness of the human race was focused on the gross material. So if you look with your physical eye, with your ordinary mode of training, and you look at the physical body, you will see what you think of the physical body. And you will not notice some very peculiar things about that body. But if you take your body, and instead of looking at the body, you look slightly away from the body, but near the body, you will very quickly become conscious of the movement of the air around the body, because it has different temperatures. You can get a slight shimmering effect without a great deal of practice. It is not an illusion, it is a fact. And with the latest type of coils, it has been shown that not only is there a movement of air, there is also a movement of a biomagnetic field, which likewise can be detected. And this was the kind of perception that Adam had before the fall. And once this clouding had occurred, he could no longer see the subtler forces, which have been called by various groups, auras and so on, which are really energy fields, which have precipitated at their centers the gross material particle. He could no longer see these fields of force, he could only see the gross precipitate at the center. So he fell from awareness of the universe as an energy system into a belief that the universe was made of material particles. Now immediately this guilt became apparent. God demoted the serpent, and then he proceeded to make a prophecy. He said that Eve, who had introduced this fall, would directly give birth to a being that would reverse the fall. He put it in the form, the seed of the woman shall bruise the head of the serpent. The serpent shall bite him in the heel. Now the heel is that part of you which, when you're walking along, you leave behind you. It is the last part of you, and therefore it symbolizes the vulnerable part of you when you're running away. Now the most vulnerable part of you when you're running away from the field of forces is that part of you that's most grossly condensed, namely the material. So on the material body, you have to imagine the material body is the heel or part of you that is vulnerable to the external stimulus. A stimulus comes to you and hits you on the body. The external stimulus is the serpent. Your physical body is the heel. But the woman was your feeling and inclination. That is to say, your awareness of pleasure, pain, and the drive from these two. And the seed of these, that is to say, the finest center of your feeling, judgment, and cognition. This will ultimately defeat the external stimulus. But it will only defeat it after the external stimulus has reduced you to the most extreme condition of suffering, which is the meaning that this serpent shall bite the seed of the woman in the heel. This is a preview of the crucifixion. When a man becomes conscious of the meaning of this statement, that the serpent will bite him in the heel, the external stimulus will bite him first in the physical body, and he then affirms that the physical body is the means whereby he carries his evolution to the term, and when he understands this, he can crucify himself deliberately. That is to say, place himself in material situations that will rapidly develop him, because they are all deliberately chosen as painful, as unpleasant, and so on. Now, there is no way for a human being to develop other than by the deliberate conscious affirmation of an unpleasant situation. It is no good doing extreme damages that you can't learn a lot from, like damaging your body absolutely by committing suicide, because it interferes with your next lesson. But subject to the rule, do not prematurely destroy the means of your education, then the thing to do is always to move into the thing that feels unpleasant, because the seed of this, the very center of this feeling, will develop out of this unpleasantness that Messiah, that Logos, that pure reason again, which will gradually move you to your center of initiative. If you do not suffer externally, you will not be driven to find the center of your initiative. Any person who, feeling very, very strongly that the situation is becoming intolerable, rushes out to accept an external stimulus in order to remove the strain, in accepting the stimulus, has actually deprived himself, for the time being, of the possibility of finding the center of their own initiative. Now, the seed of the woman is said to be, by all the theologians, the promise of Christ. Now, Christ is a word derived from the word for oil of anointing, that is, say, chrism. The oil of anointing, there is the first letter of Christ, looks like an X, a C. It's an aspirated text, and it is a whirling cross, or dynamic cross, as opposed to the static cross of Job. Now, the cross is the opposition of two forces. One of these forces can be considered as the external stimulus, and the other one the force of reaction from the organism. When the two forces meet, where they meet at the center, they vibrate, and the glyph for vibration is the letter R. Now, in English, we use the letter R, like a T with a tail on it. But in the Greek, the letter that looks like P is an R. So if you want to write R in Greek, you simply write what in English you would call a P, that is R. The reason is that whenever you posit a point, you do so by intersecting forces. And at the point of intersection, the force is shaped, and that shaping is the vibration R. So, if you throw aspirated K R, means the intersection of forces whirling around and vibrating violently. And this vibration is the differentiation of the elements of the consciousness which sharpen you up. This is the sore cross of self-illumination. Now, the letter I, the yota, is the dot at the center. And coming out of that center is the serpent again. But now the serpent is a furious serpent. He is a driven out serpent. That is to say, the stimulus energy that came in and battled with the organism has now been seen to be external and has been thrown out. So this is so far Chris. If we now cross the serpent and fix it, like Moses did, Moses nailed the cross with the serpent, or the serpent on the cross, in the desert to fix it. You clearly state to yourself the nature of the external stimulus and how it was you came to fall for it. And you go into the most tiny details about how you felt in the stimulus situation into subordination to the stimulus, and this puts a T on the S. Now where these two intersect, you get another O, and out of this other rotating zone, you get a third serpent. Now this serpent, the second one that comes out, is the serpent of enlightenment. This one is the good serpent that you read about in mythology. Now all of this word spells Christos, which means to say the opposition of an external force and the internal force of the organism, fighting against each other, vibrating violently, illuminate the being who is watching the battle. And there emerges from it the thrown out external stimulus, thrown out for observation, referred back to where it came from, the fixing of this by definition within the environment from which it came, the rotation of the forces in the environment, which are now seen to be quite different from what they appeared to be, and then the new serpent of illumination. Now obviously this illuminated being is worthy of acceptance as one who knows his own job, and therefore he's said to be anointed one. He is anointed because the very, very thing that previously enslaved him has now been the means whereby he has become illuminated. But in order to become illuminated in this way, he must deliberately move into a painful situation in order to gain the necessary turbulence in his own self. If captured by the pleasures of the situation, he keeps returning into the same situation over and over again because it is pleasant. He's not actually doing his work and he gets lost. He falls into identification with the situation that triggered him off, and he may find himself there trapped. Very often you get two beings and they meet like Adam and Eve, and they get in a contingent relation, and suddenly they're doing a figure of eight. And one won't let the other go. Because, owing to the law of the inequality of finite, they vary in their rate of evolution. And therefore one of them will be rather readier than the other to learn the lesson. And the one who is slow to learn the lesson won't let the other one learn it, and will do everything possible to hold that being subjection. And if that most terrible thing of all, self-imagery, is allowed to work, self-imagery being the opinion that A thinks that B has as A, and that A would not like to destroy in the mind of B, if that self-image is allowed to work, A can never escape from B. And so the two then become a reciprocally feeding, degenerating system together. To get out of this, it must be realized that the pain of entering into a situation, when you have learned the lesson of it, is going to be equal to the pain of extricating oneself from the same situation. Because one of the beings in it isn't going to want it to be given up yet. So the very same situation that was painful, and which you didn't want to go into, when you get into and learn the lesson, it will be just as painful to give it up, because the other person in the relation won't want you to give it up. So there is occasion there for very clear-sighted thinking if a person wishes to develop. Now this being, the bruiser of the serpent, is also called Jesus, and this means affirmation saved. The sous, which in Greek is a saviour, in Hebrew means a horse, because of course the horse is the symbol of the hierarchy of powers in the universe. Ye means affirmation, sous means saviour and hierarchical being. You cannot be saved unless you accept that there is a hierarchy in the universe. Although all beings are fundamentally, essentially identical, as the continuum of God is, nevertheless, in fact, in actuality, in the time process, they are all unequal in development. And those who are tardy in developing will try to impede the accelerating development of other beings. To realize that affirmation saves is to see why Jesus and Christ are bound together, why the person who affirms the cross of conflict between the inner motivation of a being and the external stimulus, and who can pin himself in this most unpleasant situation just in order to watch what is happening to him, so as he can finally actually detect what belongs to the external world and throw it out again, and what was his own peculiar contribution. This is a question of motivational research of an individual order. So Jesus Christ is a name for any being whatever who can, by affirming the hierarchy in the universe, fill himself on every situation, enter into situations where he needs to illuminate himself, and withdraw from the situation when he has learned the lesson, even though another being who hasn't learned it is trying to hold him in the relation. In the picture, which had happened to fall to the ground, apparently it was finished, we have seen that the God had no circumscribing line. It was made up of four letters, and these four letters are terribly important. If we write them in the right to left order, as they would be written in Hebrew, they spell the word Jehovah. Now, this word is no more than the verb to be in three tenses. I was, I am, I shall be, which is the word here, Jehovah. Now, this word derives from a whole man. First, it is written as a drawing of a whole man, then it is cut into bits, and then to the fact that writing horizontally is slightly more convenient than vertically, the parts of the name, the holy name, of Jehovah, are written horizontally. And the first part, the Yud, which is the English word Jot, which is the head of this being, funny enough, means a hand. The word Yod or Yad means a hand. And a hand is power, executive power. So the head of God is executive power. This means that the thing, the point of initiative, in the absolute, is the head of God. The head is the place where God initiates something. The word head actually means Spirit Lord, A-R, and Spirit Eater, Eater in Spirit. This head is the point of initiation. Now, his shoulders are made out of a letter that means universal spirit. In English, it is the letter E, and means the eternal, the universal eternal spirit. And these are the arms, the everlasting arms, that stretch out from the point of initiation. Let's imagine the white paper is a plane through spirit, and let's put a point on it and tap it. From that point, they go forth, this is a perspective joint, ripples. These ripples are spreading out in the plane of the eternal, and so the initiative point is ruling all through this plane of being. And that Yod and this Hay spell Yah. This is the affirmation of the dominion throughout infinity. Now, wherever this spreading out ripple goes throughout infinity, it is going continuously, and the tapping on this point of the Yod is continuously sending more ripples out, and wherever the ripples intersect, they produce further little Yod points, and each one of these elongates itself and generates at the point of intersection a wheel. Now, the third letter here is a letter which is pronounced by German Jews as Vav, and by some others as Wow, which is the first Wow in woman. And actually, it symbolizes generative power. But in this figure of God, he comes out of the heart. That is to say that God is developing, generating the power into the time world below from the center of feeling. Out of the heart are the issues of life. At the very center of your feeling, that is the point where you have to examine your motive. Motivational research consists in examining your state of feeling. So this particular letter symbolizes the prolongation downwards of the heart of God. Now this letter, written in the Hebrew like that, if we turn it and rotate it, it is the number 6 in English, and in the Egyptian it was rather more obvious, like this. It was a male organ, euphemistically called a nail, not to hit on the head, and in English it appears as the letter F, the 6th letter of the alphabet. Now, this tells you something very, very important. The power that appears from the divine and generates the whole universe after the fall has entered down and gone into the male organ. And this means to say that only those beings that have male organs actually have the power to initiate. That the power of initiation belongs to beings with the male organ. And consequently, if there is a being without a male organ, it cannot have this power of initiative, this power of starting things, this power of formulating. So the particular strange instrument symbolizes the presence in the male side of the human race of divine creativity now embodied in the individual. This power in the individual is exactly the same power that can, by turning the thing upwards, illuminate his intelligence, or the intelligence of the lady in the cave. There is no illumination other than through this strange device. Now, below this strange device is another letter of the same as the second one, the letter E, which means the eternal, and this eternal below is said to be He, or Spirit Universal, in exile. This has fallen into the time process. So we'll draw a circle for it and see that the material world of material particles is really a spiritual world that is degenerated by condensation. Degenerated means to say that it has generated divisions within itself. And these little divisions are always made by rotations, and the rotations are marked by the characteristic called inertia. So that when you come to examine the material world today in physical terms, you are concerned with mass inertias. But the mass inertias of the material world are no more than precipitations of the eternal spirit. Now, the initiative force in the nail that put Christ to the feet, you know, there's a debate about how many nails were used. Well, some think he had four, but the more subtle thinkers think that one was enough for both feet. And they had a reason for saying so, because the word foot is the word pod, which is precisely the strange instrument. Pedal extremity is the generative power in the time process. Now, if this power in the time process is allowed to suffer from the external stimulus, it cannot convert. That is to say, that as long as the male power of initiative is not exercised as initiative, but is triggered off by the external stimulus presented by the contemporary Eve, then that power cannot invert itself and illuminate the being in whom it is objectified itself. It will continue to lead him into the next lesson. It will lead him into the next lesson over and over again until he can extricate himself. Now, normally the extrication, unfortunately, is by boarding. And the person who doesn't know this to be so does not learn the lesson. He goes into the situation, he repeats the situation, he tries to get out of it because he's losing interest. He's not allowed to get out of it by the Eve in the cave, because it's her duty to keep him in the cave, so that Cain, or his intelligence, can be raised. And as she's holding him into it, he is progressively becoming bored. And finally his boredom results in bad behavior, and he then starts moving away from the unpleasant. But as soon as he's moving away from the unpleasant, he's now again under the dominion of the calculus of pleasure pain. He's no longer got the initiative. And consequently, he will be ground down in the direction until something explodes. Usually the man is dead, statistically. But if it can be seen that this particular strange instrument, which was said by the rabbis to be such a mighty power in the world, that if a man understood what it was, he would never abuse it. That is to say, never abuse it, never use it for any purpose other than that for which it was intended, that is, as an initiative weapon. When he uses it only for initiative and not for reactivity, then it is a very potent magic. In fact, that magic of the mysterious magical one is the only thing that has raised the human race. If you read carefully in your book of Genesis, you will see that Adam and Eve were not thrown out of the Garden of Eden for sexual relations. They hadn't had any sexual relations. They were thrown out of the garden for distinguishing between good and evil. And when they had made the mistake, God then prophesied that because of this, woman would proceed to deliver children and travail and grow mightily to be delivered. And they were out of the garden before they had any sexual relation. And the sexual relation was given to them as a slightly inferior magic to the first one that they would have had if they hadn't disobeyed. So that the male organ now has the peculiar function of raising humanity very slowly with minute steps through the time process. And apart from this proper use of this magic, there is no elevation for the human race. The initiative power vested in man was to infiltrate, to posit the forms of experience into the woman who had let down the man. Now the peculiar thing is this, that the sperms in a man are an exact chemical parallel of his development level, his ideas, his initiative. The feeling and inclination, the drive of his wife, are vested in the child. So that the child is always slightly better than the parent. In some respect, he sees both points of view. And every time this initiative organ takes the experience of the man, which is chemically presented through the sperms, and places the formal experience into the woman, the child is improved little by little. Even the congenital idiot is an improvement on some people, who were apparently not showing this kind of idiocy. The child has managed to cancel out certain privileges in the person that were in fact not being examined properly. The child is always better than the parents, by some degree. And therefore, as of this woman, through the placing of the experience progressively in the seed of this woman, out of the woman, through the sexual relation and the depositing of the experience of the father in the mother, there emerges a child that improves progressively until, as the prophets say, finally there will arise a child that will be so full of the formal information of the ancestral errors that it will comprehend the meaning of universal error and suddenly turn it over. Now Jesus Christ is an example of a man who is the first, historically, to reach this level of penetrating to the meaning of the whole error from Adam up to his own time. And therefore he tells the story of the prodigal son, who actually goes the whole hog in committing the errors until finally there's no error left that he doesn't know about. And when this is finally realized, substantialized in a being, then he knows there's nothing left to do. You've done all the errors, it's now time to start being decent. And he turns around. And to symbolize this point, if we said, there is a line from Abraham going up through the time process, and there is the time of spreading out of the information, the birth of Christ is the intersection point and the Abrahamic line of experience, the whole others, which has resulted in the appearance of the individual who thoroughly embodied the meaning of all mistakes, all errors. Now you see this in the book of Isaiah, where it is describing this Messiah who is to come. And the general idea that Messiah is despised and rejected of men because he's so horribly bent and twisted that he certainly must be slightly worse than Socrates, who you remember was accused by a very handsome aristocratic fellow of being a beast because of his horrid face, and replied, yes, but I have conquered all that. If you haven't been bent in all the conceivable ways that there are, the ways that you have not been bent will call you to the bending. Christ says, when you come to the point of complete error, so that all error is fixed, crucified in you, and there are no further errors left, then you can return like the prodigal son, repent, rethink it, rehang yourself on your absoluteness. And you can only do this when the external stimulus represented by the serpent has got you into so much trouble that you really have discovered that you got yourself into the trouble, that nobody led you into the trouble, there was only the occasion, the stimulus. And that the thing that led you into the trouble was your own motive in going up. Remember, Eve's motive was, it is good to taste, nice to look at, and confers power, like God. She had a motive. Now, when it is realized that even in the case of the fall, nobody pushed him, nobody pushed her, the stimulus came. The stimulus need not have been accepted. It was accepted. There was a cloud in his consciousness, and from that moment there was no way of getting back to the consciousness of the infinite, other than by the time process of going the whole hog in the error, until the errors finally realizing themselves, culminating the fixation of the concept, there are no more errors left to commit, and now it's time to turn, think again, and return to my inner development center, which will develop me from within now, because the external world has nothing to offer me whatever except the occasions of the repetition of errors already committed.